by other political parties and movements, but none of these had National Socialism's image of strength and dynamism, the missionary drive of the National Crusade. And Hitler was simply better than anyone else at tapping the rich vein of raw anger, barely concealed in the 1920s, and now opened up by the perceived failure of democracy amid mounting crisis. In addition, and something contemporaries could easily overlook in their scornful dismissal of the poverty of Nazism's intellectual offerings, the Hitler movement alone on the right offered an idealistic vision of a new society in a reborn Germany. This, it is clear, was the leading attraction for many. Though the NSDAP claimed to be above sectional interest, it was, in fact, as the crisis gripped ever more tightly, better than any other party in tapping a whole panoply of mainly middle-class interest groups through the sub-organizations it built up. From the agrarian apparatus set up under R. Walter Darey, the party's blood and soil, Blut und Boden theorist in August 1930, through organizations to cope with the special interests of workers, civil servants, lawyers, doctors, pharmacists, teachers, university lecturers, students, women, youth, small traders, even coal dealers, the party erected, mainly from 1930 onwards, a framework of affiliations that enabled it at one and the same time to speak to those specific interests, but claim best to represent them by incorporating them in an appeal to the overriding interest of the nation. In this sense, the NSDAP came to function increasingly as a super-interest party. The rhetoric of the national community and the Führer cult stood for a rebirth for Germany in which all the various interests would have a new deal. As the economic and political situation deteriorated, the rationality of voting for a small and weak interest party rather than a massive and strong national party, upholding interests but transcending them, was less and less compelling. A vote for the Nazis could easily seem like common sense. In this way, the NSDAP started to penetrate and destroy the support of interest parties such as the Bayerischer Bauernbund, Bavarian Peasants League, and seriously to erode the hold of the traditional parties such as the DNVP in rural areas. This process was only in its early stages in summer 1930, but it would make rapid advances following the Nazi triumph of the 14th of September 1930. 5. What happened on that day was a political earthquake. In the most remarkable result in German parliamentary history, the NSDAP advanced at one stroke from the 12 seats and mere 2.6% of the vote gained in the 1928 Reichstag election to 107 seats and 18.3%, making it the second largest party in the Reichstag. Almost 6.5 million Germans now voted for Hitler's party, 8 times as many as 2 years earlier. The Nazi bandwagon was rolling. The party leadership had expected big gains. The run of successes in the regional elections, the last of them the 14.4% won in Saxony as recently as June, pointed to that conclusion. Goebbels had reckoned in April with about 40 seats, when it looked as if there would be a dissolution of the Reichstag at that time. A week before polling day in September, he expected a massive success, eine Riesenerfolg. Hitler later claimed he had thought 100 seats were possible. In reality, as Goebbels admitted, the size of the victory took all in the party by surprise. No one had expected 107 seats. Hitler was beside himself with joy. The political landscape had dramatically changed overnight. Alongside the Nazis, the communists had increased their support, now to 13.1% of the vote. Though still the largest party, the SPD had lost ground, as marginally did the Zentrum. But the biggest losers were the bourgeois parties of the centre and right. The DNVP had dropped in successive elections since 1924 from 20.5 to only 7.0%, the DVP from 10.1 to 4.7%. The Nazis were the main profiteers. 1 in 3 former DNVP voters, it has been estimated, now turn to the NSDAP as did one in four former supporters of the Liberal parties. Smaller but still significant gains were made from all other parties. These included the SPD, KPD, and Centrum BVP. Though the working class milieus dominated by the parties of the left, and above all the Catholic subculture, remained, as they would continue to be, relatively unyielding terrain for the NSDAP. The increased turnout, up from 75.6 to 82%, also benefited the Nazis, though less so than has often been presumed. The landslide was greatest in the Protestant countryside of northern and eastern Germany. With the exception of rural parts of Franconia, piously Protestant, the largely Catholic Bavarian electoral districts now for the first time lagged behind the national average. The same was true of most Catholic regions. In big cities and industrial areas, though there were some notable exceptions, such as Breslau and Chemnitz, Zwickau, the Nazi gains, though still spectacular, were also below average. But in Schleswig-Holstein, the NSDAP vote had rocketed from 4% in 1928 to 27%. East Prussia, Pomerania, Hanover, and Mecklenburg were among the other regions where Nazi support was now over 20%. At least three-quarters of Nazi voters were Protestant, or, at any rate, non-Catholics. Significantly more men than women voted Nazi, though this was to alter between 1930 and 1933. At least two-fifths of Nazi support came from the middle classes, but a quarter was drawn from the working class, though the unemployed were more likely to vote for Tillmann's party, the KPD, than Hitler's. The middle classes were indeed overrepresented among Nazi voters. But the NSDAP was no mere middle-class party, as used to be thought. Though not in equal proportions, the Hitler movement could reasonably claim to have won support from all sections of society. No other party throughout the Weimar Republic could claim the same. The social structure of the party's membership points to the same conclusion. A massive influx of members followed the September election. The party recruited, if not evenly, from all sections of society. The membership was overwhelmingly male, and only the KPD was as youthful in its membership profile. The Protestant middle classes were, as among voters, overrepresented. But there was also a sizable working class presence, even more pronounced in the SA and the Hitler Youth than in the party itself. At the same time, the political breakthrough meant that respectable local citizens now felt ready to join the party. Teachers, civil servants, even some Protestant pastors were among the respectable groups altering the party's social standing in the provinces. In Franconia, for example, the NSDAP already had the appearance by 1930 of a civil service party. The penetration by the party of the social networks of provincial towns and villages now began to intensify notably. There are times they mark the danger point for a political system when politicians can no longer communicate, when they stop understanding the language of the people they are supposed to be representing. The politicians of Weimar's parties were well on the way to reaching that point in 1930. Hitler had the advantage of being undamaged by participation in unpopular government and of unwavering radicalism in his hostility to the Republic. He could speak in language more and more Germans understood, the language of bitter protest at a discredited system, the language of national renewal and rebirth. Those not firmly anchored in an alternative political ideology, social milieu, or denominational subculture found such language increasingly intoxicating. The results of what the Frankfurter Zeitung called the bitterness election, seeing the electorate partly motivated by the desire to upturn the current political system, but largely stirred by protest at economic misery, were a sensation. The immediate reaction in some quarters was fear of a bloody takeover of power by the National Socialists. Herbert Blank, one of Otto Strasser's associates, spoke of a suitcase-packing mood in Berlin editorial offices and of stock market shares being packed into a descending paternoster lift. The hysteria soon calmed, but democracy had certainly been dealt a heavy blow. The Nazis had moved at one fell swoop from the fringe of the political scene, outside the power equation, to its heart. Before the election, commented Blanc sardonically, the word Nazis had immediately prompted thoughts of the madhouse. But no longer. Brüning could now cope with the Reichstag only through the toleration of the SPD, which saw him as the lesser evil. The Social Democrats entered their policy of toleration with heavy hearts, but a deep sense of responsibility. As their leading theoretician, Rudolf Hilferding, put it, support for a government that had moved so far to the right amounted to a sacrifice comprehensible only as necessary defense of democracy in a parliament with an anti-parliamentary majority. As for Hitler, whether he was seen in a positive or a negative sense, and there was little about him that left people neutral or indifferent, his name was now on everyone's lips. He was a factor to be reckoned with. He could no longer be ignored. But he could still be grossly underrated. The anarchist revolutionary writer, Erich Mühsam, a veteran of the Munich Räterepublik, saw Hitler's victory as a true blessing for the working class. All that was needed was to give the Nazis some ministerial responsibility, and their true reactionary colors would alienate workers more rapidly than the Social Democrats in power had done. The real danger in Mühsam's crass misjudgment was the leadership of the DNVP, especially Hugenberg, the true leader of the fascist movement in Germany. Another writer with similar revolutionary credentials, Ernst Toller, was an exception on the left in regarding the danger as acute. In an article in the Weltbühne entitled Reich Chancellor Hitler, he signalled that the clock shows 1 minute to 12. Among bourgeois writers, Thomas Mann provided a thoughtful analysis of the dangers following the Nazi landslide in his German address, Deutsche Ansprache, a lecture in Berlin on the 17th of October that was much interrupted by Nazi hecklers. But his cultural pessimism, his dismay at the collapse of the humanistic and idealistic values of the 19th century into the wild and raw, crude and primitive emotions of mass society, led him also to a simplistic assessment of the NSDAP's breakthrough. National Socialism offered for him merely politics in a grotesque style with Salvation Army attractions, alluren, mass fits, showground stall bell ringing, hallelujah, and dervish-like repetition of monotonous slogans till everyone is foaming at the mouth. After the September elections, not just Germany, but the world outside had to take notice of Hitler. He was now sought after for interviews by the foreign press. One newspaper he was more than ready to talk to was the British conservative organ, the Daily Mail, whose owner, Lord Rothermere, had publicly greeted the election result as the rebirth of Germany as a nation and welcomed the prospect of the National Socialists taking power as a bulwark against Bolshevism. Hitler's interviewer, Rothe Reynolds, was won over. Hitler spoke with great simplicity and with great earnestness. There was not a trace in his manner of those arts which political leaders are apt to employ when they wish to impress. I was conscious that I was talking to a man whose power lies not, as many still think, in his eloquence and in his ability to hold the attention of the mob, but in his conviction. He is not a robust-looking man. He is slight in figure, and last night, after an exhausting day in the law courts, where he stood for over 2 hours while giving evidence, followed by a conference, he looked exhausted and his face was dead white. But the moment he spoke, I realized that there was in him a burning spirit that could triumph over bodily weariness. He speaks very rapidly, and in his voice there is a nervous energy that makes one feel the intense conviction behind his words. Hitler's exhausting day in the law courts had in fact been another well-exploited propaganda opportunity to allay suspicions of a putsch and to emphasize his commitment to a legal takeover of power. Hitler had throughout 1930, and especially during the election campaign, repeatedly stressed that he would win power legally. In the immediate aftermath of his electoral triumph, the trial of 3 young Reichswehr officers from a regiment stationed in Ulm, whose Nazi sympathies saw them accused of preparing to commit high treason, Vorbereitung zum Hochverrat, through working towards a military putsch with the NSDAP and breaching regulations banning members of the Reichswehr from activities aimed at altering the constitution, gave Hitler the chance, now with the eyes of the world's press on him, of underlining his party's commitment to legality. The trial of the officers Hans Ludin, Richard Scheringer, and Hans Friedrich Wendt began on the 23rd of September. On the first day, Wendt's defense counsel, Hans Frank, was given permission to summon Hitler as a witness. 2 days later, huge crowds demonstrated outside the court building in favor of Hitler as the leader of the Reichstag's second-largest party went into the witness box to face the red-robed judges of the highest court in the land. Once more, he was allowed to use a court of law for propaganda purposes. The judge even warned him on one occasion, as he heatedly denied any intention of undermining the Reichswehr, to avoid turning his testimony into a propaganda speech. It was to little avail. Hitler emphasized that his movement would take power by legal means, and that the Reichswehr, again becoming a great German people's army, would be the basis for the German future. He declared that he had never wanted to pursue his ideals by illegal measures. He used the exclusion of Otto Strasse to dissociate himself from those in the movement who played with the term revolution. But he assured the presiding judge, "If our movement is victorious in its legal struggle, then there will be a German state court, and November 1918 will find its atonement, and heads will roll." This brought cheers and cries of bravo from onlookers in the courtroom, and an immediate admonishment from the court president, reminding them that they were neither in the theatre nor in a political meeting. He expected, Hitler continued, that the NSDAP would win a majority following two or three further elections. Then it must come to a National Socialist rising, Erhebung, and we will shape the state as we want to have it. When asked how he envisaged the erection of the Third Reich, Hitler replied, "The National Socialist movement will seek to attain its aim in this state by constitutional means. The Constitution shows us only the methods, not the goal. In this constitutional way, we will try to gain decisive majorities in the legislative bodies in order, in the moment this is successful, to pour the state into the mold that matches our ideas." He repeated that this would only be done constitutionally. He was finally sworn in on oath to the truth of his testimony. Goebbels told Scheringer, one of the defendants, that Hitler's oath was a brilliant move. "Now we are strictly legal," he is said to have exclaimed. The propaganda boss was delighted at the fabulous press reportage. Hitler's newly appointed foreign press chief, Putzi Hanfstengel, saw to it that there was wide coverage of the trial abroad. He also placed three articles by Hitler on the aims of the movement in the Hearst Press, the powerful American media concern, at a handsome fee of 1,000 marks for each. Hitler said it was what he needed to be able now to stay at the Kaiserhof Hotel, plush, well situated near the heart of government, and his headquarters in the capital until 1933, when he went to Berlin. What Hitler said in the Leipzig Reichswehr trial, which ended on the 4th of October in 18-month custodial sentences on each of the three Reichswehr officers, and the cashiering from the army of Ludin and Scheringer, was nothing new. As we have noted, he had been anxious for months to emphasize his legal path to power. But the massive publicity surrounding the trial ensured that his declaration now made maximum impact. As Hans Frank later commented, the avowal of legality dispelled the fears of many that Hitler intended a violent takeover. The belief that Hitler had broken with his revolutionary past helped to win him further support in respectable circles. There were those who encouraged Brüning after the election to take the NSDAP into a coalition government, arguing that government responsibility would put the Nazis to the test and limit their agitation. Brüning rejected such a notion out of hand, though he did not rule out cooperation at some future date should the party hold by the principle of legality. After deflecting Hitler's request for an audience immediately after the election, Brüning did arrange to see him, as did the leaders of the other parties, in early October. The Chancellor was hoping to reach an arrangement whereby Hitler would engage in loyal opposition and moderate his clamour for an immediate end to reparations payments, while delicate negotiations for an international loan of $125 million, seen as indispensable to prevent economic collapse, were underway. Their meeting on the 5th of October, which took place to avoid publicity in the apartment of Reich Minister Treviranus, established, however, that there was no prospect of cooperation. A chasm separated them. After Brüning's careful statement of the government's foreign policy, a delicate strategy aimed at acquiring a breathing space leading to the ultimate removal of reparations, Hitler responded with an hour-long monologue. He simply ignored the issues Brüning had raised. Evidently, he did not understand the intricacies of the financial strategy that the Chancellor had outlined. Instead, starting so hesitantly that Brüning and Treviranus initially felt a little sorry for him and made remarks to encourage him, he was soon in full stride. Regular march pasts of a singing SA troop, clearly prearranged, though the meeting was meant to be a secret one, seemed to spur Hitler on. He was soon haranguing the four persons present. Frick and Gregor Strasser were there, as well as Brüning and Treviranus, as if he were addressing a mass rally. Brüning was struck by the number of times Hitler used the word annihilate, vernichten. He was going to annihilate the KPD, the SPD, the reaction, France as Germany's archenemy, and Russia as the home of Bolshevism. It was plain to the Chancellor, so Brüning later remarked, that Hitler's basic principle would always be first power, then politics. There was a telling aftermath. Despite giving his word to Brüning that the discussion of government strategy on foreign policy was absolutely confidential, Hitler immediately dictated a resume of what had been said, and his foreign press chief, Hans Stengel, leaked it to the American ambassador. Brüning clearly saw Hitler as a fanatic, unsophisticated but dangerous. Though they parted amicably enough, Hitler formed a deep loathing towards Brüning, taking on manic proportions and permeating the whole party. According to Albert Krebs, it stemmed from his strong inferiority complex towards the Chancellor during their meeting. Hitler was left to continue his relentless, unbridled opposition to a system whose symbolic hate figure was now Chancellor Brüning. Continuing the agitation was, in any case, what Hitler, like Goebbels, preferred. That was his instinct. "Don't write victory on your banners any longer," Hitler had told his supporters immediately after the election. "Write the word in its place that suits us better. Struggle." In any case, it was the only option available. As one contemporary put it, the Nazis followed the maxim, "After a victory, fasten on the helmet more tightly." Following the election victory, they arranged 70,000 meetings. Again, an avalanche passed through the Reich. Town after town, village after village is stormed. The election victory made this continued high level of agitation possible. The new interest in the party meant a vast influx of new members bringing new funds that could be used for the organization of still further propaganda and new activists to carry it out. Success bred success. But the structure of the party's support was changing in some ways. Many of the recent converts were not the fanatics of the early years, prepared to sacrifice everything for their beliefs. Their support was in some ways conditional, dependent upon success. Many left the party as quickly as they had joined. The turnover in membership was considerable. They could not be held together by specific policies, which would immediately have alienated part of the heterogeneous following, but only by common denominator slogans: national community, national rebirth, power, glory, and prosperity. Above all, the prospect of victory now presented itself as a real one. Everything had to be subordinated to this single goal. The massive but shallow, organizationally somewhat ramshackle protest movement, a loose amalgam of different interests bonded by the politics of utopia, could be sustained only by the NSDAP coming to power within a relatively short time, probably something like the space of 2 or 3 years. This was to create mounting pressure on Hitler. All he could do for the present was what he had always done best: step up the agitation still further. 6. Behind the public persona, the private individual was difficult to locate. Politics had increasingly consumed Hitler since 1919. There was an extraordinary gulf between his political effectiveness, the magnetism not just felt by ecstatic crowds in mass rallies, but by those who were frequently in his company, and the emptiness of what was left of an existence outside politics, Those who knew Hitler personally around this time found him an enigma. In my recollection, there is no rounded image of Hitler's personality, reflected Putzi Hanfstengel many years later. Rather, there are a number of images and shapes, all called Adolf Hitler, and which were all Adolf Hitler, that can only with difficulty be brought together in overall relation to each other. He could be charming and then a little later utter opinions that hinted at a horrifying abyss. He could develop grand ideas and be primitive to the point of banality. He could fill millions with the conviction that only his will and strength of character guaranteed victory. And at the same time, even as Chancellor, he could remain a bohemian whose unreliability drove his colleagues to despair. For Franz Pfeffer von Salomon, the head of the SA until his dismissal in August 1930, Hitler combined the qualities of common soldier and artist. A trooper with gypsy blood was, given Nazi racial thinking, Pfeffer's reported extraordinary characterization. He thought Hitler had something like a sixth sense in politics, a supernatural talent, but he wondered whether he was at bottom only a type of Freikorps leader, a revolutionary who might have difficulty in becoming a statesman after the movement had taken power. Pfeffer took Hitler to be a genius, something the world might experience only once in 1,000 years. But the human side of Hitler, in his view, was deficient. Pfeffer, torn between adulation and criticism, saw him as a split personality, full of personal inhibitions in conflict with the genius inside him, arising from his upbringing and education, and consuming him. Gregor Strasser, retaining his own critical distance from the fully blown Führer cult, was nevertheless also, Otto Wagner recounted, prepared to see genius of a kind in Hitler. Whatever there is about him that is unpleasant, Otto Eberstobler, Gauleiter of Lower Bavaria, later recalled Gregor Strasser saying, "The man has a prophetic talent for reading great political problems correctly and doing the right thing at the opportune moment despite apparently insuperable difficulties." Such unusual talent as Strasser was ready to grant Hitler lay, however, as he saw it, in instinct rather than in any ability to systematize ideas. Otto Wagner, who had been made SA Chief of Staff in 1929, was among those totally entranced by Hitler. His captivation by this rare personality had still not deserted him many years later when he compiled his memoirs in British captivity. But he too was unsure what to make of Hitler. After hearing him one day in such a towering rage, it was a row with Pfeffer about the relations between the SA and SS, that his voice reverberated through the entire party headquarters, Wagner thought there was something in him resembling an Asiatic will for destruction, a term still betraying after the war Wagner's entrenchment in Nazi racial stereotypes. Not genius, but hatred, not overriding greatness, but rage born of an inferiority complex, not Germanic heroism, but the Hun's thirst for revenge, was how, many years later, using Nazi-style parlance in describing Hitler's alleged descent from the Huns, he summarized his impressions. In his incomprehension, a mixture of sycophantic admiration and awestruck fear, Wagner was reduced to seeing in Hitler's character something foreign, fremdartig, and diabolical. Hitler remained for him altogether a puzzle. Even for leading figures in the Nazi movement such as Pfeffer and Wagner, Hitler was a remote figure. He had moved in 1929 from his shabby flat in Tierstrasse to a luxury apartment in Prinzregentenplatz in Munich's fashionable Bogenhausen. It matched the change from the beer hall rabble-rouser to politician cavorting with the conservative establishment. He seldom had guests or entertained. When he did, the atmosphere was always stiff and formal. Obsessives rarely make good or interesting company, except in the eyes of those who share the obsession or those in awe of or dependent upon such unbalanced personality. Hitler preferred, as he always had done, the usual afternoon round in Café Heck, where cronies and admirers would listen, fawningly, attentively, or with concealed boredom, to his monologues on the party's early history for the umpteenth time, or tales of the war, his inexhaustible favourite theme. Only with very few people was he on the familiar du terms. He would address most Nazi leaders by their surname alone. Mein Führer had not yet fully established itself, as it would do after 1933, as their normal mode of address to him. For those in his entourage, he was known simply as the boss, der Chef. Some, like Hanf Stengel or court photographer Heinrich Hoffmann, insisted on a simple Herr Hitler. The remoteness of his personality was complemented by the need to avoid the familiarity, which could have brought with it contempt for his position as supreme leader. The aura around him dared not be sullied in any way. Along with the remoteness went distrust. Important matters were discussed only with small and changing groups or individuals. That way, Hitler remained in full control, never bound by any advice of formal bodies, never needing to adjudicate on disagreements between his paladins. With his fixed views and dominant personality, he was able, as Gregor Strasser pointed out, to overwhelm any individual in his presence, even those initially skeptical. This in turn strengthened his self-confidence, his feeling of infallibility. In contrast, he felt uncomfortable with those who posed awkward questions or counter-arguments. Since his intuition, by which, between the lines, Strasser meant his ideological dogmatism coupled with tactical flexibility and opportunism, could not in itself be combated by logical argument, the party's organizational leader went on, Hitler invariably dismissed any objections as coming from small-minded know-alls. But he registered who the critics were. Sooner or later, they would fall from grace. Some of the most important matters he discussed, if at all, only with those in his close circle, the group of adjutants, chauffeurs, and long-standing cronies, such as Julius Schaub, his general factotum, Heinrich Hoffmann, his photographer, and Sepp Dietrich, later head of his SS bodyguard. Distrust and vanity went hand in hand with his type of leadership, in Gregor Strasser's view. The danger, he pointed out with reference to the dismissal of Pfeffer, was the self-selection of what Hitler wanted to hear and the negative reaction towards the bearer of bad tidings. There was something otherworldly about Hitler, thought Strasser, a lack of knowledge of human beings, and with it a lack of sound judgment of them. Hitler lived without any bonds to another human being, Strasser went on. He doesn't smoke, he doesn't drink, he eats almost nothing but green stuff. He doesn't touch any woman. How are we supposed to understand him, to put him across to other people? Hitler contributed as good as nothing to the running and organization of the massively expanded Nazi movement. His work style, if it could be called such, was unchanged from the days when the NSDAP was a tiny, insignificant, folkish set. He was incapable of systematic work and took no interest in it. He was as chaotic and dilettante as ever. He had found the role where he could fully indulge the unordered, indisciplined, and indolent lifestyle that had never altered since his pampered youth in Linz and dropout years in Vienna. He had a huge workroom, Arbeitszimmer, in the new Brown House, a building of tasteless grandiosity that he was singularly proud of. Pictures of Frederick the Great and a heroic scene of the List Regiment's first battle in Flanders in 1914 adorned the walls. A monumental bust of Mussolini stood beside the outsized furniture. Smoking was forbidden. To call it Hitler's workroom was a nice euphemism. Hitler rarely did any work there. Hanf Stengel, who had his own room in the building, had few memories of Hitler's room since he had seen the party leader there so seldom. Even the big painting of Frederick the Great, noted the former foreign press chief, could not motivate Hitler to follow the example of the Prussian king in diligent attention to duty. He had no regular working hours. Appointments were there to be broken. Hanf Stengel had often to chase through Munich looking for the party leader to make sure he kept appointments with journalists. He could invariably find him at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, surrounded by his admirers, holding forth in the Café Heck. Party workers at headquarters were no more favoured. They could never find a fixed time to see Hitler, even about extremely important business. If they managed, clutching their files, to catch him when he entered the Brown House, he would as often as not be called to the telephone and then apologize that he had to leave immediately and would be back the next day. Should they manage to have their business attended to, it was normally dispatched with little attention to detail. Hitler would in his usual manner turn the point at issue into a matter on which, pacing up and down the room, he would pontificate for an hour in a lengthy monologue. Often he would completely ignore something brought to his attention, deviating at a tangent into some current whim. If Hitler gets a cue to something he is interested in, but that's something different every day, Pfeffer is reported to have told Wagner in 1930, then he takes over the conversation and the point of the discussion is shelved. On matters he did not understand or where a decision was awkward, he simply avoided discussion. This extraordinary way of operating was certainly built into Hitler's personality. Masterful and domineering, but uncertain and hesitant. Unwilling to take decisions, yet then prepared to take decisions bolder than anyone else could contemplate. And refusal, once made, to take back any decision. These are part of the puzzle of Hitler's strange personality. If the domineering traits were signs of a deep inner uncertainty, the overbearing features the reflection of an underlying inferiority complex, then the hidden personality disorder must have been one of monumental proportions. To ascribe the problem to such a cause re-describes it rather than explains it. In any case, Hitler's peculiar leadership style was more than just a matter of personality or instinctive social Darwinist inclination to let the winner emerge after a process of struggle. It reflected, too, the unceasing necessity to protect his position as leader. Acting out the leader's role could never be halted. The famous handshake and steely blue eyes were part of the act. Even leading figures in the party never ceased to be impressed with the apparent sincerity and bond of loyalty and comradeship that they thought accompanied Hitler's unusually long handshake and unblinking stare into their eyes. They were too in awe of Hitler to realize what an elementary theatrical trick it was. The greater became the nimbus of the infallible leader, the less the human Hitler, capable of mistakes and misjudgments, could be allowed on view. The person, Hitler, was disappearing more and more into the role of the almighty and omniscient leader. Very occasionally, the mask slipped. Albert Krebs related a scene from early 1932 that reminded him of a French comedy. From the corridor of the elegant Hotel Atlantique in Hamburg, he could hear Hitler plaintively shouting, "My soup! I want my soup!" Krebs found him minutes later hunched over a round table in his room, slurping his vegetable soup, looking anything other than a hero of the people. He appeared tired and depressed. He ignored the copy of his speech the previous night that Krebs had brought him, and to the Gauleiter's astonishment asked him instead what he thought of a vegetarian diet. Fully in character, Hitler launched, not waiting for an answer, into a lengthy discourse on vegetarianism. It struck Krebs as a cranky outburst, aimed at overpowering, not persuading, the listener. But what imprinted the scene on Krebs's memory was how Hitler revealed himself as an acute hypochondriac to one to whom he had presented himself up to then only as the political leader, never as a human being, Mensch. Krebs did not presume that Hitler was suddenly regarding him as a confidant. He took it rather as a sign of the party leader's inner instability. It was an unexpected show of human weakness, which Krebs plausibly speculated was overcompensated by an unquenchable thirst for power and resort to violence. According to Krebs, Hitler explained that a variety of worrying symptoms, outbreaks of sweating, nervous tension, trembling of muscles, and stomach cramps had persuaded him to become a vegetarian. He took the stomach cramps to be the beginnings of cancer, leaving him only a few years to complete the gigantic tasks he had set himself. "I must come to power before long. I must," Krebs has him shouting. But with this he gained control of himself again. His body language showed he was over his temporary depression. His attendants were suddenly called, orders were given out, telephone calls booked, meetings arranged. The human being Hitler had been transformed back into the leader. The mask was in place again. Hitler's style of leadership functioned precisely because of the readiness of all his subordinates to accept his unique standing in the party and their belief that such eccentricities of behavior had simply to be taken on board in someone they saw as a political genius. He always needs people who can translate his ideologies into reality so that they can be implemented, Pfeffer is reported as saying. Hitler's way was, in fact, not to hand out streams of orders to shape important political decisions. Where possible, he avoided decisions. Rather, he laid out, often in his diffuse and opinionated fashion, his ideas at length and repeatedly. These provided the general guidelines and direction for policymaking. Others had to interpret from his comments how they thought he wanted them to act and work towards his distant objectives. If they could all work in this way, Hitler was reported as stating from time to time, if they could all strive with firm, conscious tenacity towards a common, distant goal, then the ultimate goal must one day be achieved. That mistakes will be made is human. It is a pity. But that will be overcome if a common goal is constantly adopted as a guideline. This instinctive way of operating, embedded in Hitler's social Darwinist approach, not only unleashed ferocious competition among those in the party, later in the state, trying to reach the correct interpretation of Hitler's intentions, it also meant that Hitler, the unchallenged fount of ideological orthodoxy by this time, could always side with those who had come out on top in the relentless struggle going on below him with those who had best proven that they were following the right guidelines. And since only Hitler could determine this, his power position was massively enhanced. Inaccessibility, sporadic and impulsive interventions, unpredictability, lack of a regular working pattern, administrative disinterest, and ready resort to long-winded monologues instead of attention to detail were all hallmarks of Hitler's style as party leader. They were compatible, at least in the short term, with a leader party whose exclusive middle-range goal was getting power. After 1933, the same features would become hallmarks of Hitler's style as dictator with supreme power over the German state. They would be incompatible with the bureaucratic regulation of a sophisticated state apparatus and would become a guarantee of escalating governmental disorder. 7. At the beginning of 1931, a familiar, scarred face not seen for some time returned to the scene. Ernst Röhm, recalled by Hitler from his self-imposed exile as a military advisor to the Bolivian army, was back. He took up his appointment as new chief of staff of the SA on the 5th of January. The case of Otto Strasser had not been the only crisis that the party leadership had had to deal with during 1930. More serious, potentially, had been the crisis within the SA. It had been simmering for some time before it exploded in the summer of 1930 during the election campaign. In reality, the crisis merely brought to a head, not for the last time, the structural conflict built into the NSDAP between the party's organization and that of the SA. This had its origins, as we have noted, in the years before the putsch. The insistence after 1925 that the SA was the party's auxiliary troop, Hilfstruppe, not a paramilitary formation, had never succeeded fully in quelling the separate esprit de corps which existed among the stormtroopers. The contempt of these party soldiers for the civilians in the Gau offices was a constant. Regular reminders that they were subordinate to the party organization were not always easily swallowed by stormtroopers who felt that they were the ones who went where the going was toughest, who suffered the casualties from the street warfare with communists and socialists. Matters had come to a head in 1930 over the question of the placing of three SA leaders on the list of Reichstag candidates. This was, however, the occasion rather than the underlying cause. It was coupled with the financial disadvantages that the SA felt through its lack of autonomy and dependence on Gau offices and the demands for an immediate improvement. After Walter Stennis, the SA leader in the eastern regions of Germany, and impatient like many of his men at the strategy of attempting to gain power by legal and slow means, had travelled to Munich in August to confront Hitler, but gained no audience. His subordinates in Berlin resigned their positions and refused to carry out any propaganda or protection duties for the party. A flashpoint arose when SA men assigned to protect a big Goebbels meeting in the Sportpalast on the 30th of August, were ordered by Stennis to appear at a parade elsewhere in Berlin. Shortly afterwards, a meeting of Berlin SA leaders ended in stormtroopers forcing their way into party headquarters, overcoming the resistance of SS men, whose organization was actually still subordinate to the SA, and seriously vandalizing the building. Goebbels was shocked at the extent of the demolition. Hitler rushed to Berlin. Goebbels told him that a settlement was urgently needed. Otherwise, the rebellion, already spreading throughout the land, would result in a catastrophe. Hitler, after speaking first to some groups of the aggrieved SA men, had two meetings during the night with Stennis, without apparent success. But the next day, the 1st of September, he appealed to a rapidly assembled mass meeting of around 2,000 Berlin stormtroopers. Pfeffer, the supreme SA leader, had resigned 3 days earlier. Hitler now announced, a move received with great jubilation, that he himself was taking over the supreme leadership of the SA and SS. He outlined the achievements of the SA and the growth of the movement. He ended, his voice almost hysterical, with an appeal for loyalty. In a piece of theatre reminiscent of the party refoundation meeting in 1925, the 80-year-old war hero General Litzmann was brought out to offer an oath of loyalty to Hitler on behalf of all SA men. Loyalty had not been without its price. Stennis read out Hitler's order providing for substantial financial improvements for the SA, deriving from increased party dues. The immediate crisis was over. A memorandum from the deputy to the supreme leader in South Germany, Obergruppenführer August Scheindgruber, dated the 19th of September 1930, did not exempt Hitler from blame for the rebellious feeling among stormtroopers. The SA had gained little recognition for an election victory which it could claim as its own, he wrote. The Berlin events had shown that Hitler had not had sufficient contact with his SA, Scheindgruber continued. Things had been brewing for some considerable time. The demand for recognition by Hitler of the achievements of the SA had been growing. The Führer, unfortunately, did not hear the warning voices. The day-to-day running of the SA was temporarily taken over by Otto Wagner, a businessman recruited the previous year by Pfeffer, a former Freikorps comrade, as his chief of staff. Wagner had used his business contacts to persuade a cigarette firm to produce Sturm cigarettes for SA men, a sponsorship deal benefiting both the firm and the SA coffers. Stormtroopers were strongly encouraged to smoke only these cigarettes. A cut from the profit went to the SA, though after Pfeffer's resignation, the Reich Party treasurer made sure that control over the funds was exercised by the party itself, not by the SA. In October 1930, Wagner passed down guidelines from Hitler indicating special tasks for the SA in the struggle for power and offering the expectation that after a takeover of power, it would become the reservoir for a future German national army. The claim within the SA leadership for a high degree of autonomy from the party leadership was, however, undiminished. The scope for continued conflict was still there. This was the situation awaiting the return of Röhm, not as supreme head, but as chief of staff, which was announced by Hitler to assembled SA leaders in Munich on the 30th of November 1930. Röhm's high standing from the pre-Putsch era, together with his lack of involvement in any of the recent intrigues, made his appointment a sensible one. However, his notorious homosexuality was soon used by those SA subordinates who resented his leadership to try to undermine the position of the new chief of staff. Hitler was forced, as early as the 3rd of February 1931, to reject attacks on things that are purely in the private sphere, and to stress that the SA was not a moral establishment, but a band of rough fighters. Röhm's moral standards were not the real point at issue. Hitler's action the previous summer had defused the immediate crisis, but it was papering over the cracks. The tension remained. Neither the precise role nor degree of autonomy of the SA had been fully clarified. Given the character of the Nazi movement and the way the SA had emerged within it, the structural problem was insoluble. And the putschist strain, always present in the SA, was resurfacing. Since his demands for Reichstag seats had been brusquely rejected, it could hardly be surprising that Stennes rebounded to an anti-parliamentary strategy. But his advocacy of taking power by force, advanced in articles in the Berlin Party newspaper, Der Angriff, was increasingly alarming to the Nazi leadership. Such noises flatly contradicted and directly placed in question the commitment to legality that Hitler had made, most publicly and on oath, following the Reichswehr trial in Leipzig the previous September, and had stressed on numerous occasions since then. Hitler was forced in February to fire a shot across the bows to Stennes in an article in the Völkische Beobachter denouncing the lie that the National Socialists were planning a violent coup, saying he understood the needs and feeling of anger of the SA and SS, but warning against provocateurs in the movement's own ranks who were delivering to the government the legitimation for persecuting the party. In a speech to SA men in Munich on the 7th of March, Hitler stated, "I am accused of being too cowardly to fight illegally. I am certainly not too cowardly for that. I am only too cowardly to lead the SA to face machine gun fire. We need the SA for more important things, namely for the construction of the Third Reich. We'll keep to the Constitution and we'll still come to our goal. The Constitution prescribes the right to come to power. What means we use is our concern." The spectre of a ban on the party loomed very much larger with the promulgation of an emergency decree on the 28th of March, giving the Brüning government wide-ranging powers to combat political excesses. "The party, above all the SA, seems to be facing a ban," wrote Goebbels in his diary. Hitler ordered the strictest compliance with the emergency decree by all members of the party, SA and SS. But Stennes was not prepared to yield. "It is the most serious crisis the party has had to go through," commented Goebbels. It was high time to take action. Goebbels was summoned to a meeting with Hitler and other party leaders in Weimar and told on arrival that Stennes had been deposed as SA leader in eastern Germany. No sooner had Goebbels received the news than the telephone rang from Berlin to tell him that the SA had occupied the party headquarters and the offices of the Angriff. Despite putting a brave face on it to his immediate entourage, Hitler was shocked. The Berlin SA leadership published on the 2nd of April a frontal attack on his un-German, un-Deutscher, and boundless party despotism and the irresponsible demagogy. Hitler's immediate reply was to renew his bestowal of plenipotentiary powers on Goebbels to undertake with whatever ruthlessness necessary the purge of all subversive elements from the Berlin party. "Whatever you need to do in fulfilling this task," wrote Hitler, "I will back you." Hitler and Goebbels worked hard to ensure declarations of loyalty from all the Gauer. Stennes, increasingly revolutionary in tone, succeeded in winning support from parts of the SA in Berlin, Schleswig-Holstein, Silesia, and Pomerania. But his success was short-lived. A full-scale rebellion did not occur. Ironically, the Berlin police, the butt of so many vicious attacks by Goebbels in the Angriff, now helped the party win back control over its headquarters and over the newspaper's offices. On the 4th of April, Hitler published in the Völkische Beobachter a lengthy and cleverly constructed denunciation of Stennes and an emotional appeal to the loyalty of SA men. He stressed his own unique role in creating and building up the movement as its founder and as its leader. He poured scorn on Stennes's contribution compared with the sacrifices he himself and others had made for the movement. He accused Stennes of systematically undermining the loyalty of the SA men to him through attempting to separate the idea from the person, the same distinction he had rejected in the case of Otto Strasser the previous May. Hitler labeled anyone trying to lead the movement into an open war against the state as either a fool or a criminal. Having marched himself in 1923, he had to recognize that any further attempt would be madness. He declared his intention to eradicate this conspiracy against National Socialism, root and branch, and demanded SA men choose between police sergeant, retired Stennes, or the founder of the National Socialist Movement and the supreme leader of your SA, Adolf Hitler. Even before he wrote, the revolt was crumbling. Support for Stennes evaporated. About 500 SA men in North and Eastern Germany were purged. The rest came back into line. Goering was empowered to re-establish control in Stennis's area. Berlin was excluded from his remit. Jealously guarding his position, Goebbels had discovered that Goering had tried to exploit the situation to take over some of his own powers in Berlin. "I'll never forget that of Goering," he wrote. "One could despair of mankind. It's a heap of frozen shit." He was placated when Hitler publicly called upon all Berlin SA men to show loyalty to his friend Goebbels. The crisis was over. The SA had been put back on the leash. It would be kept there with difficulty until the seizure of power. Then the pent-up violence would only be fully released in the first months of 1933. With great energy and no little organizational skill, Röhm now took the restructuring of the SA in hand. By the end of 1931, its numbers had trebled from 88,000 in January to 260,000 in December. With such a rapid increase, a more tightly knit organization was necessary. The SA's image was also changing in some ways. Outside the big cities, the SA were not always archetypal street fighters and political hooligans. Marxists were often scarce on the ground in rural areas. The SA's role looked correspondingly different. Farmers' sons and lads from other upstanding local families, attracted by the success of the Nazi movement and often encouraged by friends, now often joined the SA instead of, or as well as, shooting or sporting clubs. Much of their party work was often little more than pageantry and parading. In some places, the pious SA marched in uniform each Sunday to church. It was far from disreputable to belong to such an organization. Under Röhm's hand, nevertheless, the SA was returning to its character as a paramilitary formation, and now a much more formidable one than it had been in the early 1920s. Röhm had behaved with exemplary loyalty to Hitler during the Stennis crisis, but his own emphasis on the primacy of the soldier and his ambitions, suppressed as they were in 1931 for the transformation of the SA into a popular militia, bore the seeds of conflict still to come. It prefigured the course of events which would reach their denouement only in June 1934. 8. Not only political but personal crisis beset Hitler in 1931. On moving in 1929 into his spacious new apartment in Prinz Regentenplatz, his niece, Geli Rabal, who had been living with her mother in Haus Wachenfeld on the Obersalzberg, had come to join him. During the following 2 years, she was frequently seen in public with Hitler. Rumours already abounded about the nature of her relations with Uncle Alf, as she called him. On the morning of the 19th of September 1931, aged 23, she was found dead in Hitler's flat, shot with his pistol. Hitler's relations with women, as we have already remarked, were, in some respects, abnormal. He liked the company of women, especially pretty ones, best of all, young ones. He flattered them, sometimes flirted with them, called them, in his patronizing Viennese petty bourgeois manner, my little princess or my little countess. Occasionally, if the stories are to be believed, he made a clumsy attempt at some physical contact, as in the case of Helena Hanfstengel and Henriette Hoffmann, the daughter of his photographer, who was to marry Baldur von Schirach, from the 30th of October 1931, the Reich youth leader of the NSDAP. His name was linked at various times with women from as diverse backgrounds as Jenny Haug, the sister of his chauffeur in the early years, and Winifred Wagner, the Bayreuth maestro's daughter-in-law. But whatever the basis of the rumours, often malicious, exaggerated, or invented, none of his liaisons, it seems, had been more than superficial. No deep feelings were ever stirred. Women were for Hitler an object, an adornment in a men's world. Whether in the men's home in Vienna, the regiment during the war, the Munich barracks until his discharge, and his regular gatherings of party cronies in Café Neumeier or Café Heck in the 1920s, Hitler's environment had always been overwhelmingly male. Very occasionally a woman would be admitted to our intimate circle, recalled Heinrich Hoffmann, but she never was allowed to become the centre of it, and had to remain seen but not heard. She could occasionally take a small part in the conversation, but never was she allowed to hold forth or to contradict Hitler. Beginning with the semi-mythical Stephanie in Linz, Hitler's relations with women had usually been, at a distance, a matter of affectation, not emotion. The brief flirtation with Mimi Reiter had not broken the mould. Fond of Mimi though he had been, the loving devotion of the besotted 16-year-old remained unrequited.